You've seen our next guest in movies such as Coming Home, which he was nominated for an Academy Award. Recently, he was in The Astronaut Farmer. He was in a science fiction movie I really liked in the 70s called Silent Running. Also appeared in movies like Support Your Local Sheriff and The Great Gatsby and Black Sunday and another one of my guilty pleasures, a movie called Digstown with James Woods. His name is Bruce Dern, and he has written about his life in a new memoir that's just out called Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. Bruce Dern, it's a pleasure to have you on here.
Thank you, sir. It's nice to be here.
Can we start with some stories about Digstown, only because it's a movie I never hear anybody talking about, and so you're the only guy I can ask about it.
Well, it did not do well in theaters, but I think it's one of the 10 highest grossing video rentals of all time. I don't know quite why. I think the ad campaign didn't work well, and it was right at the tail end of MGM going under totally as a distributor and a maker of films, and it was an MGM film, but otherwise it was magical. I just thought it's right up there as one of the best all-time Sting movies as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I always love movies about a good con, and also with two guys who frankly looked like they wanted to eat each other's face off, you and Jimmy Woods. That's a pretty intense duo right there.
Yeah, that was a nice piece of casting. He's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And so is Lou Gossett, but Jimmy Woods and I had at each other, and that was fun.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other movies you made. Of course, one of the parts of the Bruce Dern legend is you're the guy who shot John Wayne in the back in the movie The Cowboys. And I read the book, and I was surprised that he chose you for that role. How did that come about?
Well, I think Mark Rydell actually submitted me to the Committee of One. And I had done a film with John Wayne earlier called The War Wagon, where I just played a little part with he and Kirk Douglas, and he liked me in that. And I had also been in the Green Beret, which I left early because when I got down there, I was informed I was going to be the cover set. So I had to hang around for 9 weeks to do 6 lines, and I asked out of that, and because that was right when Laura was born, and he let me go from that. So I think he kind of felt he owed me one and whatever, and he liked me. He kind of kept track of my career ever since The War Wagon, as you can do from Balboa Island if they see anything from there. I don't know. That's where he lived on his boat, the Wild Goose. So I think he approved it, and then every single day on the set from the first day I got there, Mark Rydell, the director, had told me, go after him every single day. And the first day he came up to me and he said, I've given permission to you to kick my butt every single day, so have a little levity, will you, please? I'm 74 years old and have one lung.
Uh-huh.
I said, the lungs don't make a difference. You're standing there, and you're still smoking a pack of cigarettes. Obviously, you don't care, so why should I? And we got on great from them. But the wonderful thing about he and the stars of that era for us, the boys and girls that came to Hollywood when we came, they always insisted that we push the envelope. They always insisted that we go out further on the edge than they did as actors. And I was very, very grateful for that, particularly from him. He said, take more chances, take more risks. Maybe if you want me to get down on my hands and knees, I told him in that scene after the fight, to get down on his hands and knees and crawl toward me after I'd got his gun, of course. And Mark Rydell says, no, God, you can't ask him to do that. And Wayne said, oh, just shut up, for God's sake. Let that kid have me crawl a few feet if he wants to.
Did he understand, did John Wayne understand in having you do that role that you would always be associated with being the guy who shot John Wayne?
He told me just before we did the stuff where I pulled the trigger and shot him that he said, they're going to hate you for this. So he understood it very well. I mean, he knew that he was going down, and he knew he was a legend.
Yep.
And he also knew he was John Wayne, and he was bigger than life. Some of those folks were actually bigger than life, and he was probably a monument to life, you know.
Now, what was it like when you saw The Cowboys, that movie, in a theater with an audience? What was their reaction?
Well, when he was shot is in the 38th minute of the movie, and the audience gasped. If I'd have seen it with the 200 buyers in Hollywood, they'd have gasped simply because they'd have said, are these people crazy killing Wayne in the 38th minute? That's halfway through the third reel.
Yeah.
I mean, what are they going to do for the rest of the movie? The people will leave the theater. But no, they gasped because they were shocked. A, he was shot in the back. B, he was shot dead. And C, all that was left was 10, 12-year-old kids.
Right.
And so they knew what they were doing, though. And he knew what he was doing. It was just a wonderful experience, and he always had felt that one of the things that I had that he liked about me when I did play bad guys was that I had a sense of humor about it, and he felt that all bad guys in history, both in history and especially the history of the West, and in film history of the West, had a kind of a sense of humor to their malevolence. And he liked that. And he always felt that Richard Widmark, he always used to talk to me about. And he always had this kind of dry sense of humor when he played people. And even Jack Palance, he talked to me about. And Shane, he said he had kind of a dry sense of humor, the way he kidded Alan Ladd and stuff. And he was a great historian as to good guys and bad guys. And one of the things he was very disappointed in his own career was that he never really got to play a bad guy. He always said he'd like to play a bad guy. And I remember Mr. Kazan once told me, he said, you know, I had a role once I wanted Duke, meaning John Wayne, to play. But he said, I never had the guts to ask him.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with actor Bruce Dern. His memoir is called Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. So John Wayne couldn't be a bad guy, but you have always been one of the great movie bad guys. Who did you make a conscious decision early on that you'd make a career out of that?
No, I was just cast that way. And nothing indicated in the plays I was in or when I first came to Hollywood that I would be that. But, you know, you go into offices and you call your agent immediately when you see a script. And even though you're the fifth cowboy on the left, if the part's there, you go for it. And, you know, in those early television shows, the guys that I got chosen to play were very bad guys. And I wasn't about to hold out for a leading role. I wasn't an obvious leading man, so you took what you could get in the late 50s and early 60s, and that was it.
And one of your more famous roles is the one I mentioned that you were nominated for an Academy Award. That was Coming Home, in which you played a guy who goes off to fight in the Vietnam War, leaving your wife, Jane Fonda, behind. She befriends a wounded war veteran, played by John Voight. And then the Coming Home is you returning from Vietnam and really feeling out of place in your home and in your community. And it was an absolutely phenomenal performance. You write in the book about getting advice on how to play that from Max Cleland, who was a Vietnam vet himself and later went to Congress from Georgia. What did he tell you about being that guy?
Well, the biggest help that Max was the fact that he'd been there, done that, and was living proof, because he was missing a couple of limbs. And that was number one. Number two, he gave me statistics about the amount of men that had come back and committed suicide that were seemingly whole. So when you describe John Voight, you know, having been there and come back devastatingly crippled, Max's whole thing to me was, not necessarily are the physical handicapped and crippled more or even as crippled as those that come back and appear to be whole. And that was the key to the way I played my character, realizing that a man could walk around looking to others like he was seemingly a whole, full-bodied person, and yet in spirit and soul, he was totally shot.
That movie came out in 1977 at a time when we had not, to our own shame...
78.
You shot it in 77. It came out in 78. At that time, we had not really welcomed home our Vietnam veterans in the way we should have. And I was always curious about what the reaction was from vets to you about the character you played in that movie.
To this day, Paul, I have people that fought in the war, men and women, who will come up to me, and not as prevalent now as they did before, but certainly for the first 15, 20 years, as people were still discovering the film, who would put their arms around me and just hug me for a second and then hold me back, look into my face, and just thank me for doing something that put their cause in the forefront. And that was the fact that we got it enough to tell their story. And the hardest problem Coming Home had was it came out at the same time as The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now, which are both fabulous movies, but full of the pyrotechnical side of the war, and ours was a very private story about the war at home. And they were very grateful that that story finally got told. And it's never really been told about that war at all. I mean, some people have compared it to the Frederick March movie, you know, Best Years of Our Lives. And that's probably a better movie than Coming Home. But Coming Home will hold its own with that movie or any other, because it tells about the story at home. But the tribute that gives to the men and women that came home not to applause, was probably the first time that had ever happened in American history. And to this day, those people don't get over it. And that's a lot of why I go in the ocean at the end also.
Yep.
Look, Cody, I ain't seen this cousin Eunice in about 3 years, and believe me, I would like to leave it that way for about another 30 years.
She that bad?
She's worse.
What's wrong with her?
Well, I was afraid you was going to ask that. Let's just skip on past some more morbid details and say that Cousin Eunice is just about the most ornery, black-tempered, loud bellowing, ugly as a mud hen female that you ever wanted to see in your whole life.
That is a very young Bruce Dern in the 1960s TV series Stoney Burke, one of the many times he's appeared on screen and played a kind of ornery character himself. And he writes about his career in a new book called Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. Bruce Dern here on the Paul Harris Show, also, of course, known as the father of the terrific actress Laura Dern. Do you go see everything that Laura does?
I used to go see it all in the theater. Now I catch up with it because some of them don't open the same way that some others do. It all depends. But I end up within a month after they've come out of having seen every single thing she's been in, yeah.
Was it awkward for you as her dad to see her in some of the more sexy movies like Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet?
That was the toughest one.
Wild at Heart?
That was the toughest one. Yeah, I have a bit of a problem with William Dafoe, but otherwise, I can get around that. I met him once, and we just kind of shook and moved on. But I'm not possessive. I mean, I get the drill. I mean, she knows what she got into. I know what she got into, and it's a business, you know.
Yeah, it's the family business, which actually leads me to Family Plot, a Hitchcock movie that you did in the 70s. And in the book, you say you sat next to him every day for the 10 weeks you were shooting that movie. And what wisdom did he impart to you?
He imparted to me probably an entire college education of 4 years. I mean, I skipped out of the University of Pennsylvania about 10% into my junior year, and Hitch finished those 2 years for me and then gave me 4 years of graduate studies at Oxford, you know. I mean, he was just fabulous. He would never look at me. He would sit in his chair, and he was such a big man, it was hard for him to turn to the side. Even his head, and he just had a pacemaker installed, one of the early pacemakers. So he didn't move to the side well at all. He moved forward and backward well. So he'd look straight forward, and I'd look kind of straight forward, and I'd look at him, of course. But and he would just talk out loud to me, and we'd sit in his car when we were shooting when it was real hot and there was air conditioning, and he'd sit in the front seat and I'd sit behind him, and we'd carry on these conversations, and there weren't a lot of lapses. I mean, he'd just carry on a conversation and I'd listen, and it was fun. I mean, it was as if he was looking at me every second. He wasn't ignoring me. He was fabulous. I mean, he got me. That was it. And there's a wonderful story in there about the meeting I got he and Mr. Frankenheimer to get together on. And it's the fact that he would do that, and that Frankenheimer was so touched by it and everything. And then when they finally got together, Frankenheimer had all these questions that he wanted to ask Hitch. And before he could ever ask one, Hitch asked him why he left the light on in the booth in Manchurian Candidate. That was the only question that ever got asked, and Frankenheimer was so stunned that Mr. Hitchcock, A, had even seen the movie because he was famous for never going to movies, and B, that he would ask that question, and his answer was fabulous at first, because the first thing he said, well, because that's what you'd have done. They got along fabulously, and then he explained why, and Hitchcock said, of course, that's why you'd leave it on. We have to see what Raymond is doing. Otherwise, the audience won't know what the antagonist is up to.
Was he a good director for an actor like you?
Excellent. He was. What was great about him, other actors would find very crippling, including some of the actors I worked with on that film. But he knew the frame was perfect. And he knew that within the frame, he needed to be entertained, which was the reason he said he hired me, because he felt I was entertaining and unpredictable. And he knew the frame was predictable and it worked and it told the story he wanted to tell. Now, within that, he wanted to be entertained and have it to be kind of off the wall. So since he had the protection of the right frame and the right scene and the way he was staging the scene and everything, you had very limited physical opportunities to move around within that area. But the freedom of the dialogue and the delivery and just talking to people. I mean, Barbara Harris, who was my partner in that, who was a fabulous actress. She got out of the business to teach acting in the high school several years ago. But, I mean, you look at her in Nashville and some of the other things she was in. She was fabulous. And he got along great with us because we were like, he called us his wild cards, you know.
Did you ever teach acting?
Yes, I did. I taught from like the early 60s until, maybe 72 when I finally stopped. And I actually stopped because I got very concerned about, I taught very much in a almost psychiatric kind of atmosphere, and where my theory of acting had always been that acting is the ability to be publicly private. Therefore, you can't really teach people less than 24, 25 years old because there's no history there for them to draw on. And then when there is, you're asking them to go inside and pull these things out of themselves and expose them to everybody. And these personal pieces of behavior, which just makes every one of us capable of being an actor if we want to be, if you're willing to expose those things. Well, when I was teaching, there was a great deal of acid around and other kinds of things around, and kids were coming into my class on all kinds of stuff I wasn't sure of, and their behavior was very erratic, and I got frightened, and so I stopped teaching.
You are a member of the Actors Studio. You studied with Lee Strasberg. How come I've never seen you on Inside the Actors Studio with James Lipton?
Well, because I think Mr. Lipton, I'd be surprised if he's used more than 20 members of the Actor Studio in all the years he's had the thing. He was sold the name by Mrs. Strasberg, Anna, after Lee died, and he was allowed to buy the name of the Actor Studio. And he believes more and uses the title of the Actor Studio to draw actors and actresses in the entertainment industry that are topics of conversation and hot, so to speak.
Yeah.
And not necessarily even know where the Actor Studio is. I mean, I'm sure at least 10% of his guests couldn't find it if you put them at 42nd and 8th Avenue. It's not that far away. It's within a half a mile. But It's just that's his personality. That's the way he does it, and it's his show. And he was crafty enough to get the title, and he's using it. It's not benefiting the studio very much, but you know, we kind of gave it to him, so there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, it's a shame that you've never been on there, because you've got some great stories to tell, and you tell quite a few of them in this book, which I really, really enjoyed reading. What are you working on now?
Well, I just formed a company, a movie company called Harry Rose Productions, and I've always been befuddled these last few years that I'm missing the people in movies nowadays, and I'm missing the conflicts of the relationships and who the people are. And we're going to make a movie called Heart's Location, which a girl named Ashley Reed wrote. And it's going to star myself and Laura and my ex-wife, Diane, who's Laura's mother. And it's about a father-daughter and ex-wife relationships and finding out who people are at the ages we are now, what they're up to, what they were up to then, and where it possibly could lead to, and the possibilities of things working out or not working out. And basically the whole reason for the company is I want to do things that pursue the idea of when we are faced with opportunities to say things that we need to say, and both sides really know they need to say these things, they don't say them.
Well, I look forward to seeing it, and I really enjoyed the book, and I've enjoyed the stuff you've done through your movie career. It's just been terrific, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks for your time today, Bruce.
Well, thank you very much, and let's hope that the Cardinals lose a second one in a row tonight to the Dodgers.
Well, now, what would your old friend Billy Bob Thornton say about that?
Well, I've been two nights in a row, and I haven't seen him, so I don't know. He's running around with Brent Briscoe, another Cardinal fan.
The book is called Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. He calls it an unrepentant memoir. Bruce Dern here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.